good afternoon. So we have a group surrounding here of participants from our Exploring Monastic Life program, which has been going on for just about 2 weeks now, and we just have a few more days left. And so people are very much looking forward to your talk. And I think, as you suggested, you know, talk and say some things about, you know, monasticism in America and practice. And then we can have some dialogue and people can ask some questions.
Okay. How is my voice coming across?
I think quite well.
Is everybody able to hear it?
Do we need to bother with the music?
No, I think you finished this. Yeah, go ahead.
And how is my image coming across?
Very refined.
You know, they say in America today, image is everything.
I should just tell you before we start that we had an ordination yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so we have our first monk at the Abbey.
Oh, I see. Was he ordained by a Chinese monk?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. We found, I don't think you know Venerable Jendi. She's a Chinese nun.
I know Venerable Jendi. She was sitting behind me at the...
Oh, that's right. Yes, of course.
In fact, I had some correspondence with Jendi back, could be three years ago. She did a Chinese translation of a book published by the Buddhist Publication Society, The Life of the Buddha by Venerable Nyanamoli. Then she had questions to ask me about it.
Okay.
And then I met her last year in Hamburg also.
Oh, that's right. Mm. Yeah, of course. Okay, so she and I have been friends for quite a number of years, and so she was able to arrange for one Chinese master who's in the States now, visiting from Taiwan. And he has some temples in Taiwan and also some temples in the U.S. And he very kindly came out to the Abbey yesterday, or actually 2 days ago, and then gave the ordination yesterday.
Mm-hmm. In what language was the ordination conducted?
Chinese and English. and sign.
What is that?
Sign language. You know, like stand up, sit down. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you want me to speak, to start speaking?
Sure. Go right ahead.
Okay. So I use a very general topic, which I call being a Buddhist monk in America today. And I will treat this topic, dividing it into three parts. One is the Buddhist aspect. The second is the monk aspect, and then the third is America Today aspect.
Are you talking about monks specifically or monastics?
I'm sorry. I have to say this. When I use the word monk, I really mean a monastic, meaning monks and nuns together.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry for that. In fact, I had made a mental note to clarify that point. But...
That's what friends are for.
Yeah, okay. I have a certain resistance to the word monastic because in my understanding it's originally an adjective. So one says monastic person. I know Chinese is very convenient. It has one word, qujiaren, which means a left home person, and then it's used for either monk or nun.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first aspect is being a Buddhist. And so when one becomes ordained as a Buddhist monastic or seeks ordination into the Buddhist order, the first thing that one is doing is one is situating oneself into a particular religious heritage. This is the Buddhist heritage, the broad Buddhist tradition. And I deliberately use the expression Buddhist religious heritage because I do consider Buddhism to be a religion. Some people prefer not to consider Buddhism a religion, to speak of it as a way of life. And generally the reason why they have this preference is because they think that the word religion implies theism, that is the belief in a god, usually blind belief, a lot of worship and ritual. And so they insist that Buddhism is not a religion, but a way of life. We had a visiting monk here, a senior monk, last week, who asked me whether I consider Buddhism a religion. I said, yes, I do. Then he corrected me and said, no, it's not a religion, it's a way of life. Okay, but in my view, to think of religion in this way is too narrow. Many years ago, before I was ordained, before I went to Asia to become ordained, I used to teach world religions. This was in California, Fullerton, California. And then in the first class in my course, I came up with four criteria for determining the nature of a religion. Okay, and the first criteria is that it's a body of thought and practice that addresses the question, what is the real nature of the world? What is true reality? What is the highest reality behind or beyond the apparent phenomena of the world? What is the source of everything that we know? What is the ground of everything? Okay, so these are some of the questions and issues that come under this first heading of a religion. Second, what is the real nature of a person, of a human being? When we look within ourselves to discover something that is more real, more abiding, then the religion answers the question, what is that which is real? What is abiding? What is there beyond our superficial personalities? Or what is the real nature of our phenomenal being? And then the third question, what is the highest good of human life? What is the most worthy goal of human life? And fourth question is, what is the way to the highest good? What is the correct way to live one's life in order to realize the highest good? Okay, so using these four questions or perspectives, we can understand Buddhism as a religion. And even though Buddhism invites investigation, it invites questioning, still, it also invites faith, what in Pali we call saddha. Some translators prefer to translate this as confidence or trust, but to me, those words are rather weak, and I prefer faith because that is a word which suggests the emotional aspect of our commitment. Okay, so when one becomes a Buddhist, then in doing so, one accepts certain principles on trust. One places trust in a teacher that one regards as somebody who is fully enlightened, this is the Buddha, one who has understood the real nature of things, who has realized the highest good, and who points out the path to us in order to guide us to the highest good. Okay, so when we encounter the Buddha, then this invites and even involves a degree of trust in things that we can't directly see and experience for ourselves. And as one approaches the thought of monastic ordination, it is important to establish this trust within oneself to make it firm. Of course, at the beginning, there will always be doubts, questions. But when one ordains, then one should have the faith, the confidence that one's teacher is the Buddha, and his teaching is the teaching that one is going to use as the guidance for one's life as a monastic. And so even though this faith will mature over time after one's ordination, at the beginning one has to have a clear sense that my confidence, my trust, my faith is in the Buddha and his teaching. And so even when one becomes a lay Buddhist, one does so by going for refuge to the three jewels, and at least in the Pali system of order of monastic ordination, when one ordains as a novice, I'll say monk, that's my experience, one first goes for refuge again to the three jewels. Okay, now, because Buddhism has historically divided into different traditions, when one becomes a Buddhist, one generally aligns oneself with a particular tradition, a particular Buddha school, often connected with a particular Asian country and Asian culture. In the Buddha's time, there was no division of Buddhism into different schools, different traditions, but everyone just followed the Buddha's teaching as he laid it down. But over time, Buddhism evolved, brought forth different schools, and these different schools, different traditions, different ways of understanding and practice took root in different geographical areas. At the time I became a monk, this would be early 1970s, in order to ordain, generally one had to go to an Asian country. And so this firmly connected one to a particular country, a particular culture, and the form of Buddhism that flourished within that culture. Often for many who became monks in those days, this created certain difficulties adjusting to a different country, adjusting to a different culture, having to eat different foods, adapt to a different climate. And so, amongst all of the Westerners who ordained, say, in Sri Lanka, I think in the time that I was there, I might have seen 100 Westerners come. And of those who came, perhaps 80 to 85 left, disrobing and going back to their home countries. Now that Buddhism has come to America, it's possible to ordain in this country. Not many places to ordain, but there are some. And already in American Buddhism, some interesting developments are taking place, which I will come to later. But now, you yourselves are following broadly the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, and so that is your root tradition. However, you also have a teacher, Venerable Chodron, who is American and open-minded and wide-visioned, and so you, through her, then you are able to get what I would call an open and wide view of Buddhism. Her way of approaching Buddhism is in many ways traditional, but from my encounter with her, I see that she's not narrowly restricted to a particular tradition. But still, as you become her disciples, you follow her approach to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition to which she belongs. Okay, so in this way, when one becomes a Buddhist, especially a candidate for ordination or one who has taken ordination, one situates oneself within a particular Buddhist tradition. Okay, now I come to the topic of becoming a monk or a nun, a monastic person. Okay, when one becomes a monastic person, then one places oneself in an especially close relation to the three jewels of Buddhism. Becoming a monastic is an act of renunciation. It's an act of renunciation that follows the example that the Buddha himself set when he went out on his quest for enlightenment. When the Buddha decided to leave the palace and then seek enlightenment, didn't, of course, take ordination, but he cut off his hair, his beard, he discarded his princely clothes, and then he put on the saffron robe or the ochre robe of the sannyasi, the sadhu, the abhijita, the renunciant of Indian culture in that time. And he adopted all of the particular features of that renunciate way of life. Okay, so when we become monastics, in a sense, we are striving to become images or reflections of the Buddha. We wear the same kind of robes that the Buddha wore, even though the colors and the styles have varied somewhat from tradition to tradition, but still we wear a particular robe which marks us as a renunciate follower of the Buddha. We shave our heads just like the Buddha did. And what's most important is that we leave the home life. If we have a family, we have to leave our family behind. And we go to live in a monastery, a temple, living a very different life from a lay person. Okay, secondly, in becoming a monastic, we devote our lives to the Dharma. Becoming a monastic means that we model our whole life on the Dharma. You could say that the life of a lay Buddhist is always involving some degree of compromise between the demands of the world and the demands of the Dharma. But becoming a monastic person means that one gives up the activities that are distinctive of the lay life, earning a living by working at a remunerative job, marrying, having a family, or in any case having romantic relationships, and instead one is committing oneself to a life of renunciation, a life which will involve a great deal of solitude, a life which is committed especially to absorbing the Dharma into oneself and making oneself a living embodiment of the Dharma. Becoming a monastic person gives one a lot of time for study and for practice. This is, in fact, we could say, the special reason why the Buddha created a particular distinctive lifestyle for the monastic person. And so the major reason for us to go forth is to have that time, the ideal external conditions for learning the Dharma and for putting it into practice. But having this large amount of time, large chunks of time to oneself, can, is on the one hand, we could say it's a great blessing, a benefit, but it can also be a burden. This is something that I realized for myself when I was living in Sri Lanka. As Western monks in Sri Lanka, we generally were not pulled into the routines of the monasteries where we were staying, but lived somewhat apart, and we had virtually the whole day to ourselves. But for many people, especially Westerners who became monks, at first this was considered something really special, really a blessing. But over time, when one has such long blocks of time all to oneself, after one's initial enthusiasm starts to wear off, it can become felt as a heavy burden. How am I going to fill my day without distracting activities? No television to watch, no friends or not many friends to associate with, no opportunities to go out on the town every once in a while. And so, if one is not able to use one's time skillfully, those large blocks of free time, which earlier seemed like the open sky, now start to feel like a heavy weight, a sack of potatoes or a sack of cement that one is carrying on one's back. And so for those who, it almost inevitably happens that when one first becomes a monk, maybe one's meditation is very energetic, suffused with a lot of joy and bliss, but that wears off and then one faces sort of almost like a desert of ennui, you know, of boredom, of barrenness. And when that happens, if one doesn't have the strong confidence and skillful way of using one's time, one becomes discouraged, disillusioned, and might leave the monastic life. And so one has to know how to prepare a proper and effective schedule for oneself. Perhaps in your monastery the schedule is already prepared, but still, supposing you have large amounts of time to yourself, you have to know how much time to devote to study, how much to meditation, how much to other activities. And in my opinion, it's wise in the early stages to adopt a balanced approach, balancing study and meditation along with devotional work, devotional practices, and work for the monastery. Now, as monastics living in the West, especially living in a Western monastery, an American monastery, you'll probably have a fair amount of time that you're involved in communal activities. Probably there will be periods where you have to do work for the monastery. You'll have community meetings, group activities. And this gives you a certain advantage over those of us who grew up as monks in Asia. Communal life, in my opinion, is a great challenge to the ego. And what I found, again living in Sri Lanka for long periods alone, is that when one lives under those conditions, one could become hardened in one's views and understanding of the Dharma, also fixed and very much attached, even addicted, to one's own particular schedule, one's own way of doing things. And these become subtle areas in which the ego, the sense of I and mine, can thrive and flourish. But when you live in a group, then your ego is constantly thrown up, constantly encounters challenges. First, you have to submit to the instructions of your teacher, which might not be completely in agreement with your own plans. And while the teacher will generally have a compassionate concern for his or her students, my own opinion is that the teacher shouldn't always allow the students to do things their own way, but should create difficulties and obstacles for them. Am I touching on some sensitive points? Okay, so a good teacher will sometimes make you do things that are not in agreement with your own plans, even though his or her instruction should always be in accordance with the spirit of the Dhamma. Okay, then you have to work in harmony with your fellow monks and nuns, and so this means that sometimes you'll have to come forward and take the initiative in certain projects, and then you get subjected to criticism from others, maybe challenges from others, and sometimes you have to remain firm in your decisions. Other times you have to recognize that the advice, the opinions of others might be better than your own sense of what's proper. Okay, at other times, others will take the lead, and then you have to follow, even though their way of doing things will be different from your own. And so living together in a monastic community will mean that you have to make compromises, and not just compromises, but for a true monastic means that you often have to reconsider your own understanding, reconsider your own way of doing things, and be able to recognize from time to time that the suggestions of others are better than your own. Perhaps their understanding of the Dharma is better than your own. And then you have to change and adjust yourself. If you refuse to change, that leads to conflict, to disputes, which creates trouble for yourself, creates trouble for other people, and then creates a kind of sour atmosphere within the community. But to preserve a good, harmonious atmosphere in the community, one has to adopt the position that one has to be able to recognize that the positions of others might be the proper way of doing things. One point of advice that my first Buddhist teacher gave me, because I used to be extremely obstinate about my opinions and my understanding of things, and I would always often would argue with him. And one piece of advice he gave me is, when I feel that argumentative mood coming over me, to reflect, I might be right or I might be wrong, but the important thing is not to defend my own position, but to try to find out objectively what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what is false, and then to accept what's right, reject what's wrong, accept what is true, and reject what is false. Okay, so living in a monastery, one becomes involved in communal activities. But at the same time, while involved in communal activities, one always has to remember what I would call the foundations or guiding principles of one's life as a monastic, so that one doesn't become just completely engulfed by the community, engulfed by the group. Another point that has to be carefully considered when one becomes a monastic is that, in a sense, one is no longer completely one's own person anymore. Not only in that one now belongs to a monastic community, but even more broadly, that one is now a member of the Buddhist Sangha. And as a member of the Buddhist Sangha, even though you might be a timid mouse in your personal character, but now on the world stage, you represent Buddhism. In the eyes of others, you're a Buddhist monastic. And so, whether you go out of the monastery, say to the town, traveling on a plane, going to other countries, wherever you go, people are looking at you as a representative of Buddhism. They know from your robe, your shaved head, what most people will know, that's a Buddhist monk, that's a Buddhist nun. So now, through your behavior, your conduct, you have to promote the proper image, the good image of Buddhism. Okay, so when one becomes a monastic, you're not just your own person, but you are, we could say you're just, you now become a link in a tradition that goes back 2,500 years. You inherit this tradition, 2,500 years of Buddhist practice, Buddhist understanding. You belong to the same community, the broad community, as the great disciples of the Buddha, like Sariputta, Moggallana, Ananda, through the whole heritage of the Gelugpa tradition, of Tsongkhapa, and all of the Dalai Lamas and Panchen Lamas. And so you're an heir to that tradition. And as an heir, you have to make proper use of the family legacy that you inherit in order to pass on to future generations. And so through your conduct, your behavior, you have to earn the respect and admiration of others for the Dharma. And also you have to work to make yourself a proper heir of the Dharma who can pass on this tradition to others. Another point that arises from this, your status as a Buddhist monastic, is that the Buddhist community consists of two main sections. One is the monastic sangha, and the other is the lay community. And these two, the Buddha says, are interdependent. The monastics receive their material support from the lay community. Lay people make the donations which enable monastics to have their dwelling place, a monastery, a temple, their food, their clothes, all the other necessities. And so as monastics, we have to in turn interact properly with the lay community. Those who are advanced in their study and practice can teach lay people the Dharma, but even novice monks and nuns, through their behavior, have to serve as a field of merit for the lay community. When lay people make offerings, they do so with the thought, the faith, the trust, the confidence that these monastics are leading worthy ways of life, which constitutes them as a field of merit. And so we as monastics have to live, behave, conduct ourselves in a way that will reciprocate the kindness that others show to us by making offerings to us and supporting us in our efforts to live the monastic life. Okay, now I come to the third part. This is what I call being a Buddhist monk in America today, with emphasis on America today. Okay, first of all, being a monk in America today has certain special challenges. First, that America is largely a secular society, and to become a monastic person means that one is stepping out of secular society. So one finds oneself almost in a confrontation with one finds oneself going against the stream, the mainstream of our society. And then not only is America a secular society, which has, even the Roman Catholic Church has only a very limited role for monastics. And so there are monasteries, Catholic monasteries, located here and there, but one hardly sees Catholic monks coming forward and representing their religion on the main platform of Catholicism in America. But for Buddhism, the main representatives are the monastics who come forward in public roles. And so in this way, we're coming forward and facing a predominantly secular society. And then, in its religious nature, The United States, of course, is not a Buddhist country, but predominantly a Christian country. You could say it's a secularized, but still very religious Christian country. And so then as Buddhists, we find ourselves followers of a foreign religion, a religion which comes from a different culture, from a different part of the world. And so when we combine these two, being monastics in a secular society, being Buddhists in a predominantly Christian society, one could feel very alienated, very much at odds with one's fellow Americans. And this is a problem that we have to face, but it's a problem that to some extent is ameliorated for you because you're living in a monastic community. So you have other monks and nuns to share your experience. And when you go out in public, generally I think it's best to go in pairs so that you feel that you have some companionship. I remember the first period when I was back in America as a monastic, this was from 1977 to 1982, the Hare Krishna movement was still fairly strong in those days. So when I would go out, people would yell after me, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Now that doesn't happen anymore. But a few years ago, when I was visiting my parents, one time I went out for a walk, and I was walking along, and then I heard a voice calling out, is that a guy or a dame? And then the voice got louder. Is that a guy or a dame? And I thought, just keep your mind on your feet, left, right, left, right. Louder, is that a guy or a dame? But I just kept on walking until I got out of earshot. Another time, again at my parents' house, taking a walk around the neighborhood, walking down the busiest street, I heard one voice calling out to another guy, hey, Harry, that's what you're going to be like 5 years from now. I was tempted to turn around and say, is Harry really interested in what? The cessation of suffering? But I was a little bit afraid if I did so that I might not be on the path to the complete cessation of suffering. But another time walking around, again, taking a walk in my parents' neighborhood, walking down the street, then a car pulls up alongside me, and I think to myself, just keep your eyes down, mind on the feet, left, right, left, right. The car is drifting alongside me. Uh-oh. The car pulls up a little ahead of me and stops. I think, just be patient. Arouse your loving kindness. Then somebody comes out of the car. I hear the door slam. I see a figure walking towards me. I look up, and it's a man with an Asian-looking face holding his hands out together, you know, with the Anjali gesture. He says, Venerable Sir, are you going someplace? May I offer you a ride? And it turned out he was a Thai Buddhist. Okay, anyway, this is a little bit of a detour. Okay, so living as a Buddhist monastic in a secular Christian society can give one a lonely feeling, but through your companionship with other monastics, then you can get a sense of strength and of encouragement. But still, to remain firm in one's commitment as a monastic, one again needs this strong sense of faith, devotion, trust, and commitment to follow the Buddha's path, no matter how difficult it might be. Then, in America today, we have some interesting transformations, changes taking place in Buddhist monastic life itself. Even though Buddhist monasticism here is still in its infancy, we can see the seeds of some major changes at work. For one thing, here in America, we have, perhaps for the first time since the extinction of Indian Buddhism, we have all of the different major Buddhist traditions meeting in the same country, the same culture. Now, this has certain advantages and also some disadvantages or challenges. The advantage is that it gives us an opportunity to widen and broaden our experience of Buddhism, to study and to practice in different traditions. The disadvantage for a beginner or relative beginner is that it can sometimes lead to eclecticism and random experimentation, and this can bring sometimes confusion, disillusionment with the monk's life, and then lead to disrobing. In my opinion, the best approach is to first establish firm foundations in a particular tradition. This, of course, will be the tradition at which one takes ordination. Study and practice under the guidance of your teacher for a number of years. And then, when you gain maturity, then if you wish, then you can study and practice in other traditions as a way of expanding your horizons. But first, you have to establish deep and secure foundations in the tradition that you have chosen to ordain. I should add a footnote to this, and this is that I believe that for Buddhists of all traditions today, it's very important to learn the fundamental, historically earliest teachings of Buddhism, those teachings that we could most reliably ascribe to the Buddha himself. And unfortunately, I should say that these teachings were not largely translated in Tibetan. In the phase of when Buddhism came to Tibet, the different stages, the early teachings, for some reason, were translated only very selectively. And so the Tibetan Khandzur contains only translations of only a few sutras from the early phase of Buddhism. And so Tibetan masters usually learn about the fundamental teachings from later works like the Abhidharma Kosha and other late scholastic works. But I think it's important for Buddhists of all traditions to go back to the primary sources, the Nikayas, and for those who know Chinese, the Agamas. Okay, another important new development in Buddhist monastic life in America, and that is the elevated status of women. In traditional Asian Buddhism, I must say very frankly, as almost all of you know, this is not the case. Though generally, what I would say for Buddhism in Asian countries, at least I've experienced it, in lay life, secular life, women have almost an equal status with men. In Sri Lanka, it's very much like that. I hear it's like that. In Burma, women are very strong in the families. Perhaps in Thailand. I don't know Tibetan culture very well at all. But when it comes to monastic life, either there are no formally ordained nuns, or else they have a subordinate status. But in Western Buddhism, the way it's been developing, and nuns have, ideally, they should have an equal status. And maybe in some traditions this has not yet come, but women, their status is developing very rapidly, very strongly. Now, in the United States, we have women who have taken bhikkhuni ordination in the Theravada tradition. And, of course, we have women following Tibetan Buddhism who have taken full monastic ordination. So we have to also say, not yet in the actual Tibetan monastic system. Okay, so this is the way in which Buddhism is developing in America, different from the way it's developing in Asia. And this should give some strong confidence and encouragement to women who take ordination. So there's still further work to be done before they attain fully equal status. One point I'll make in closing, and that is that as Buddhist monastics living in America today, we also have a particularly important role in presenting a challenge to mainstream American life. Mainstream American life is, let's say, it's driven by consumerism. The guiding ideal is that one should earn wealth in order to purchase goods and to enjoy sensual pleasures. As Buddhist monastics who have come generally from a middle-class background, who have received a good education, who have been able to enjoy the pleasures of mundane life, we then decide to renounce them, to lead a simple life, a life of dedication, a life devoted to spiritual study, spiritual cultivation. This sounds a very strong challenge to the dominant consumerism, sensualism, and materialism. And in doing so, our role, you could say, is to dispel the delusions, the false beliefs about where happiness is to be found, about the meaning of strength and power, about place where real freedom is to be found. And so even though our life as monastics might be difficult, even though we might find many challenges, through our dedication to the monastic life, we can also challenge and hopefully transform the current of life in present-day America. Okay, maybe at this point then I'll pause and then open the floor to any questions or any comments, and then we can have some discussion. Does that sound all right?
Yes. Yes, thank you very much. Venerable Semke is ready with a question.
Venerable, one of the things that I've always been stymied about with the Christian religious background in this country is that its origin was in the Middle East.
Right.
What happened, and why is it that we've gotten amnesia about it? Because I think that since we've forgotten that, even though the Buddhism has come to America coming from Asia, it's like the origin of the religion was based far, far away, and that Jesus was not an American. Has the culture just simply lost the sense of its origin as far as Christianity went? And why have we forgotten that? Because that really just set us up for a lot of bias.
I don't know why America has lost the sense that Christianity comes from the Middle East, but maybe because Christ, Christians today are heirs to, you know, to several centuries of Christianity that's developed in America. What I say that America, or at least some Americans, have lost the sense of is that America is fundamentally, in its founding principles, is not a Christian country. It was deliberately established by its founders as a secular country, a non-denominational country. And even though they make, maybe the Declaration of Independence makes a reference to we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, I don't remember how it goes, but that's probably the only reference to a Creator in the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution makes no mention of anything that would define America as a Christian country.
So we've sort of invented our own. I mean, our Jesus has lost his heritage. I think to the great loss of it, you know. And that's,
yeah. But also we should remember that the loss of a sense of the Middle Eastern origins of Jesus is not something distinctive of American Christianity. I think this is probably true also of Christianity once it moved to Europe, became doctrinally defined in terms of Greek philosophy, and that formed the basis for early Christian doctrine. And then when out of Catholicism, well, then Christianity became merged with European political and social institutions, particularly when it was adopted by the Roman Empire, then it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. And so then, at that point, Christianity underwent a major transformation to turn into, instead of being a persecuted religion of missionaries and converts coming from the Middle East, it became the guiding philosophy, the guiding religion of a widespread empire. And I think it was this merging of Christianity with the idea of empire that
lost its way.
Yeah, that gave a sense of what's called Christian triumphalism. And then that might be what is underlying the current merging of the Christian identity and American identity that's taking place in American society and, unfortunately, in American politics today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. I'm close.
Yeah. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear very clearly.
Okay, so I'm curious, with all the talk about the available opportunities now in the West, looking with all the experience that you have, if you were seeking ordination today in the Theravada tradition, since that's your background, where would you go, and who would you seek to teach or to learn and to study with?
I don't really like to mention particular names of people.
I understand that.
Excuse me?
I understand that.
Or to mention particular places. Yeah, I just don't like to mention particular things like that.
Okay.
So I should say that in how we explain these things, I don't know what might say it comes through connections from an earlier life, but for some reason I felt a sort of natural gravitation towards Sri Lanka rather than towards Thailand or to Burma. So I don't. If I was seeking ordination today, I don't know how things would work out. But back in those days, somehow I felt drawn naturally towards Sri Lanka.
Bhikkhu Bodhi?
Yeah.
I have a question for you. This is Venerable Tarpa.
Hi.
You said guiding principles to be in a community, that you needed those, but not to be engulfed by the group. What does that mean? And what advice would you give from your experience of community life in that regard?
Well, I mean, I hope I'm not imposing on, let's say, the framework of training at Shasta Abhi, but as monastics, one also needs time to be with oneself, so that one needs time for one's own studies and practice, and not always to be involved in group activities.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bodhi. This is Kim from Singapore. I would like to ask a question on a personal basis.
On what?
On a personal level, your personal experience. How do we convince our loved ones about leading a homeless life so that it will not be too painful for them? Can you enlighten me on that? Thank you.
Okay, by loved... Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. By loved ones now, do you mean parents?
Yes, parents mainly.
Mainly parents.
Yeah.
And children for some of us.
Yeah, because the approach would be quite different depending upon the particular person that one stands in a relationship to. If it's parents, I'd say one should gradually prepare them. If one is considering leading the homeless life, one should prepare them gradually. And of course, it will differ according to one's parents' possible response or reactions to Buddhism. If one's parents are, say, open-minded, then one could try to, of course, one informs them that one is interested in Buddhism, that one is going to a Buddhist center, Buddhist monastery, maybe spending periods there on retreats or study programs. And so one's parents know in advance that one's becoming more involved with Buddhism. If they're open-minded, then one could give them some introductory literature on Buddhism, speak to them about Buddhism. If they're really open-minded, one could invite them to come to the monastery or temple for a visit. And in this way, one's decision to ordain will come to them gradually. It won't come to them catastrophically. Okay, if one's parents are complete followers of another religion or would be completely opposed to one's ordination, then it is very difficult, and particularly to take ordination, to take the full ordination, one requires the permission of one's parents. So there are ways in which teachers in Asia get around that particular requirement. But my feeling is it's best for oneself, as well as for one's parents, to do so with the permission and understanding of one's parents. So even if one's parents are not disposed to have a friendly attitude towards Buddhism, still one should try one's best to make them appreciate some aspects of Buddhism, or at the very least to make them understand that you have to take responsibility for your own life, and that since you're an adult, they should respect your decision to make your they should respect your decision to live your life in the way that you think is best. And then sometimes, even though they might be initially resistant to Buddhism, if they could at least respect your decision to follow your own path, over time they might come to soften their attitudes and then to fully accept you as a monk or a nun. Okay, over.
Further to that, I'm in my mid-40s and have two grown children who are 19 and 24, and this is a challenge for me as well. My mom is actually totally supportive, so parents are easy on my side.
Now, are your children now independent, that they can live their own lives, and especially the child who's 19, she?
My son is 19. My daughter is 24.
Yeah.
They are living independently. My daughter's actually married and has a child as
well. Oh, then you don't have, of course you should tell her what you intend to do, and hopefully she'll have a good feeling about it. But that, whether she approves or not, even if she disapproves, that should not be a constraint on your decision to ordain. You have there's no need for you to get her approval. In the case of the son, the 19-year-old son, I mean, if he's still going to school and needs your support to get through school, would that be the case?
Not so much. He actually just, on his 19th birthday, got a bit of a trust fund, and he seems to be more independent-minded.
Yeah.
But my daughter is particularly concerned about, having access to me as a monastic.
Yeah, this is the thing, the respect in which Buddhist monasticism is different from other forms of Indian monasticism, Brahminic monasticism. In Indian Hindu monasticism, when one becomes a monastic, then one really drastically, radically cuts all relations to one's family. It's like one has died, but is still alive. Whereas when one becomes a Buddhist monastic, the Buddha first encouraged his monastics to still visit one's parents and to see to the needs of one's parents and to maintain a relationship with one's parents. And then as a monastic, you're not living in a walled-off, fully enclosed monastic setting, so that your children still have access to you. They should be able to come to the monastery to visit you, to talk to you. The relationship becomes somewhat different, because ideally you don't relate to your children anymore as those who are uniquely your children, but they become sentient beings, people who are looking to you for, you know, for guidance and inspiration. But still you can have a relationship with your children that is not cut off.
Bhikkhu Bodhi, if I can be so bold,
yeah,
to reword the last two questions,
yeah,
how can somebody let go of attachment to their parents and their children?
Okay.
I think that was the real question.
Okay.
If I'm not... Am I wrong or right? No.
Okay, what I would suggest is that one transforms one's ordinary attachment into loving kindness and compassion. You know, understanding that the act of renunciation, it's a going into homelessness, but it's not an abandoning of one's parents and children. The duty of a child is to promote the well-being of its parents, especially when the parents grow old. And the duty of a parent is to promote the well-being and happiness of the children. And so one could think that as a monastic, I'm still working, or especially working, for the well-being and happiness of my parents and my children. Except I'm doing so not in the secular, worldly way, but now I'm doing so at a higher level, in a spiritual way, which so one could dedicate one's merits to one's parents, to one's children, but also to avoid a kind of narrow attachment, one should also try to broaden one's perspective, and then by reflection and meditation, considering that all sentient beings, particularly all human beings, at one time or another in this beginningless samsara, have been my mother, my father, have been my children. And this way one gets a detachment from one's present parents and children, but maintains the loving kindness and compassion towards them. Okay, that's the way I would handle that.
This is Dallas. I'm just wondering about what you said about challenging mainstream society. How do we avoid going to the extremes of proselytizing or just hoping they'll notice?
How to avoid going to extremes of proselytizing?
Or just hoping the world will notice.
Yeah, first, I would say as Buddhists, we really don't try to proselytize. And if one tries to proselytize, in the sense of approaching people, say, on the streets, going to people's houses, no, seriously, knocking on doors, saying, have you accepted the Buddha as your... Have you ever thought what is going to happen to you when you die? okay, so we don't proselytize in that way. And we don't... Maybe when I'm speaking with we, I'm really speaking about myself, but I think I represent the general Buddhist approach. And we don't try to convert people to Buddhism, to persuade them to embrace Buddhism. But we remain available, try to interest people in the Dhamma, and when people come to seek the Dhamma, then we teach and give instructions. But I'd say if you're trying to proselytize, one is taking a wrong track, which is not in the best spirit of Buddhism. Because proselytization, to me, seems like an attempt to lay my trip on somebody else. But we wait until other people... We wait for other people to feel the need within themselves to seek the Dhamma, and then when they come to seek it, either directly by coming to the monastery, or maybe on the outside going to a lecture on Buddhism, then we present the Dhamma in a very straightforward way, and let them consider for themselves whether they want to embrace it fully, accept parts for their own use, or if they reject it and go someplace else, we don't try to hold them back and to pull them to Buddhism. Okay.
Hello, this is Ethan again. I have another question.
Okay, go.
So I'm struggling a lot with the idea of rebirth, and
okay.
I was curious maybe if you could touch on that, and also I keep posing this question to people. If you couldn't find yourself to believe in rebirth, would you have still chosen a monastic ordination?
Would I have chosen?
Yeah.
Okay. First, the idea of rebirth. What I say to people who are fairly new to Buddhism and attracted to Buddhism, but they have some trouble with the idea of rebirth. Okay, when I teach the Dhamma, whenever it's appropriate, then I bring in the teaching of rebirth. I don't try to, you know, take a circuit tour around, to take a detour around the teaching of rebirth, you know, something like a cluster bomb, dangerous to touch. But when I come to topics, areas within the teaching in which the teaching on rebirth is quite integral, then I will present the teaching in a very straightforward, I hope a very clear way. And sometimes times I tried to do it in a somewhat persuasive way. But I say if one has trouble with the teaching of rebirth, don't worry about it. But first approach the Dhamma through those aspects which touch on one's present experience, which one could see and verify for oneself in one's present experience. But then I also say that one should recognize that the teaching of rebirth is an integral part of classical Buddhism. It wasn't taught by the Buddha as, we could say, as a doctrine in bold type or in italics. You know, something that you have to believe, an article of faith. But the Buddha taught the doctrine of rebirth. First, it was part of the background of shared understanding within the Indian culture of that time. But it's not just part of the cultural baggage of Buddhism, but also it, we could call it the basic structuring principle of the broad Buddhist worldview. It's a teaching which provides an understanding of, we say, of our situations in life, a teaching which is very fundamental to Buddhist ethics, and that enables us to understand the consequences of our action, not only those that are visible here and now, but the way our actions have an impact upon our long-range destiny. And then, of course, the teaching of rebirth is what underlies the Buddha's teaching on samsara, the beginningless round of rebirth, which is the backdrop for the Buddha's project of seeking nirvana, liberation, and the full enlightenment of Buddhahood, which is something which generally has to be undertaken through many, many lives. Okay, so what I say is, first, as far as what one commits oneself to, commit oneself to what one, to the Dhamma as it has an impact on one's present life, to those aspects that are visible here and now, but also learn the Buddha's teaching and then try to see how the teaching of rebirth fits into the other dimensions of Buddhist doctrine, and then try to look back on your own life from the standpoint of the teaching of rebirth and see what effect this teaching will have on your understanding of your own situation. Okay, that's the way I would answer the question.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hope to send you, also to send your monastery, I have now the DVDs on the, it's called, what is it called, Exploring the Word of the Buddha. It's my full course on the Majjhima Nikaya.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's about 125 lectures. Mm-hmm. So there are some sections on that which deal with the teaching of rebirth. So those you can listen to. And also online, you can find in various places, I have 10 series of, you can find it on the Bodhi Monastery website, 10 lectures on Buddhism, which I gave actually in 1981. And one of them deals with karma and rebirth.
Can we take any questions? Bhikkhu Bodhi, I have a question about over this course, we've been focusing on a sutra called Fruits of the Homeless Life.
Right, yeah.
And today we went over some things that related to superpowers.
Yeah.
Six of these supernatural powers or whatever. Yeah. And what I was thinking about these is, these were related to the third or fourth jhanic state. I think it was the third, fourth jhanic state.
Well, they're based on the fourth jhana.
Right, so I couldn't really see why an arhat would need any of these, unless you were going to need these to understand the last, which was basically, you know, where you went into the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
So all the other ones kind of seemed like unnecessary unless you were going to keep going on to be a Buddha. And I'm just wondering if that, what you might say about that.
Well, if I had the first, I wouldn't have to talk to you on the telephone right now.
That'd be nice. Okay, I can see that.
Okay, my understanding, and this is my personal understanding, I haven't seen an explanation or an answer given to that, to the question you asked, in the classical texts. So my understanding, in the Buddha's time, there were ascetics, you know, yogis, meditators, who had those powers. And so they were considered, you know, they're not in any way necessary for the attainment of liberation, but they are adornments of an enlightened person. And the possession of them testifies to, we call it the spiritual fertility, the spiritual fruitfulness of the Buddha's teaching. And so the Buddha's, you know, some of the foremost disciples developed those powers, not some of them who were yogis before encountering the Buddha, even had them before they met the Buddha. But probably most developed them only after they started practicing under the Buddha's guidance. And I think they would have developed them in order to testify through possession of these powers to the fruitfulness of the Buddha's teaching, and to show that the Buddha's teaching is at least equal to the most potent of the other outside teachings.
Thank you very much.
And also, I would also say that some who possess these powers, you know, could use them as aids for the propagation of the Dhamma. You know, the ability to multiply one's bodies, one could go into other realms to teach. One could use some of these powers sometimes to, one is not supposed to use them generally to try to impress people in order to convert them. But under special conditions, it says one can use a demonstration of psychic power in order to break down somebody's resistance and bring them to the Dhamma. Okay, and then the last two of the superpowers, the recollection of previous lives and the divine eye to see the arising and passing of beings, those two could be used, this is again my understanding, to get a broader and deeper understanding of the suffering of samsara in order to propel one towards liberation. Okay, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is Kathleen. You mentioned that some fundamental teachings came later to Tibet or only show up in the Abhidharma. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
So when I speak about fundamental teachings, what I mean are the discourses of the Buddha. Okay, so to my knowledge, the Kanjur has translations of, I don't know the number, but it's only a few of the discourses preserved in the agamas or the Nikayas. The Nikayas and agamas as whole collections were not translated into Tibetan. Why that's so, I don't know. Probably in India, in this late period of Indian Buddhism, 8th, 9th centuries, maybe those early collections were no longer regarded as especially important. And so, even an Abhidharma Pitaka was not translated into Tibetan. not even the Savastivada Abhidharma Vitaka. But what was translated into Tibetan was the Abhidharma Kosha, and perhaps some other later Abhidharma works. And so when Tibetan scholar monks learn the early teachings, they get them through the Abhidharma Kosha and works from that period, but not through the actual discourses of the Buddha preserved in the Nikayas and the Agamas.
I think one of the seven Sarvastivada,
yeah,
Abhidharmas was translated into Tibetan, but the Tibetans do rely principally on Vasubandhu.
Maybe one was translated. This I don't know.
Yeah, there was one. In terms of the sutras, I think that would be a really interesting thing to investigate because, you know, in reading the Pali Sutras and listening to many of your discourses, I'm finding so many similarities, you know, in terms of what I've learned from the Tibetan tradition. Now, whether what I've learned from the Tibetan tradition is purely through the classical Indian commentators, or if the Tibetans in general, even the Mahayana sutras, they don't read the sutras so much themselves. It's not some kind of partiality there, but they really base it on the Nalanda tradition and the classical Indian commentators. But I think that there are, you know, many sutras that are found in the Pali canon that were also in Sanskrit and translated. But it would be a really interesting thing to investigate and find out, because in the Lamrim teachings, many of the examples and different things, I'm finding those exactly in the Pali Sutras.
Yeah, this could be the case. In fact, what I think happens is that a lot of these commentators, when they're supporting their points, quote from early sutras.
Yeah.
I noticed this during the Dalai Lama's course in Pennsylvania when I was looking through parts of the Lamrim Chinmo. Then I saw that Tsongkhapa would quote, as the great, maybe Gunapatra, Gunaprabha.
Yeah, Gunaprabha.
Has said, and then he'll quote Gunaprabha, but within that quote from Gunaprabha, there's a citation from an early sutra.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think that there's a Sanskrit commentary to the Abhidharma Kosha that was translated into Tibetan, and that commentary to the Abhidharma Kosha, I'm trying to think of the name of the commentator.
It was Vasubandhu who wrote an auto commentary.
So he wrote the auto commentary, but then there's a sub commentary on that.
Oh.
But that sub commentary quotes many Agama sutras. Yaso, it's Yaso. Yasodhara, not Yasodhara.
No. Yasomitra?
It could be Yasomitra, right.
Okay. It'd be very interesting, you know, to do some kind of study with the sutras to see which canons, you know, between the three existing canons, what sutras they have in common.
There is call this a concordance. Prepared between the Nikayas and the Agamas.
Ah.
It's by a Japanese Akunama. It was done in the 1920s. But now it's being updated, and there's a website which is also bringing in the Tibetan parallels. It's called Sutta Central. if you're interested, let me just get it. The link to it. Yeah, it's www.sutacentral.net.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. It has a Tibetan collection. And so then we could go from the Tibetan. Yeah. But the correspondences are not yet put in. It's still in progress. Oh, yeah. In fact, no. I'm sorry. There are the correspondences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has the correspondences. Mm. And actually, there's quite a lot.
Yeah.
No, maybe not so much. Perhaps about 35, 40.
But do they have the whole Pali Nikaya in there? All the Nikayas and Sutras?
Yeah, it has all the Pali Nikayas and Vinaya and Abhidhamma.
Mm.
But I don't see correspondences for the Abhidhamma yet. But maybe there are, you know. Anyway, they just have the headings. But for the Nikayas, they do have all of the parallels.
Venerable, this is Venerable Chinni with a question, kind of taking us back to the original topic. I do a lot of the publicity for Shravasi Abhi, and I find that I'm in a place where I feel like a lot of what I would like for our communication to do is to educate the people who receive it about what a monastic community is or why they're important. And at the same time, sometimes I think maybe I'm trying too hard and we should just live our life and do our practice and not worry what they think, and that they will see and respond accordingly. So I'm just wondering if you can comment on the experience of both, I don't know, how it is to both educate and then be really humble and know that I have hardly anything to educate about at this point in my own ordination, and to simply practice. Do you understand my question?
I'd say not so clearly.
Okay, so like, what is the balance really between our work as being new monastics in a new country where there's hardly any Buddhism, as far as educating people about that monastic tradition? How important is that in our thinking about how we establish ourselves here?
I would think it's good to have some information about, of course, about Buddhist monastic life on the website. Again, I hope I'm not treading on any feet, but I think for a newly ordained person, one shouldn't be spending all of one's time updating the website, seeking material to put on the website, but one also needs time for one's own development.
Okay, thank you.
But I think she's also asking, as we live in an area of Washington where nobody hardly knows what in the world a Buddhist monastic is. I mean, they don't recognize the robes. It's not like in New York or California. Yeah. And so there, it seems to be a certain need for an education about, well, what is Buddhism and what is a Buddhist monastic. And no, we aren't Catholic and we don't do what the Catholic monastics do. And we aren't Hare Krishnas. And we're not just a cult of weirdos. You know, because we could just live up on this hill, completely mind our own business, student do our practice, and then people could think all of those various things about us. Or we could make an effort to educate some of the people in the surrounding community. Is that?
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. No, I'm not joking.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of area you're living in, whether it's a primarily, I guess it's a rural area.
Yeah, it's rural. And we live 45 minutes away from the used-to-be center of the Aryan nation.
Wow.
But the people here are very nice.
Yeah, we have very nice people.
open-minded.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
I mean, they're mm-hmm. everyone I've ever met here has been very kind.
One has to be a little careful because if it's also, even though they're kind, but if they're fundamental as Christian,
you're kind of
then
libertarian,
any effort you make to inform the community mm-hmm. about what you're doing as Buddhists, they might misinterpret it as attempts to compete with them, to proselytize, mm-hmm. to convert them to Buddhism. But if there is something like a school or a town center, which has lectures on topics of general cultural interest, then you might ask them if they would like to have a lecture on Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If there's in the town, sometimes if there's a bookstore, perhaps the bookstore will have lectures.
This town has hardware stores. There is not a bookstore in our town. It has one stoplight, two grocery stores.
And there's no institute of higher education
and very,
in the county.
When I tried to find bookends in this town,
yeah.
for the Abbey, I had a hard time finding them, even in the hardware stores.
Okay, life gets at the hardware store. Yeah.
Well, as long as you go on buying hammers and nails.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, kind of on a similar vein, your personal experience in terms of living in America and primarily being a Judeo-Christian culture, or roots, how that is in your personal experience, either with other monastics of Christianity or just in your world or visiting your parents, of what that experience has been like. And I know you've gone to the Western monastic conferences, but any personal experiences of that for you as being a monk in America today?
Presenting a challenge to the secular Christian society of America. It's very seldom that I actually go outside from the monastery now. I feel a little bit hypocritical. But my major excursion is to Long Island to visit my mother is not alive anymore, but to visit my father. And then I just take, usually every day, a couple of walks around the neighborhood. Years ago, during my first day in the United States, I spent 3 years living in the Sri Lankan Buddhist Temple in Washington, D.C. And at that time, I had much more interaction with broader community, surrounding community than I do now. In those days, people from the schools in the area, not only in that area, but Maryland, Washington, even Virginia, would sometimes invite us to go to the school to give lectures on Buddhism, which were generally well received. We would have sometimes events together with Christians, Christian churches, rabbis, Jewish synagogues. Yeah, but that was a long time ago. So I think it depends very much on one's own personal and temperament. Now, in my older years, I've become somewhat reclusive.
Since we're in this is Ethan again. Since we're in a program called Exploring Monastic Life, for some of us lay practitioners, I was curious what your feelings are on lay practitioners and how necessary it is to reach enlightenment if we choose to stay and don't become monastics. if it would be possible.
Okay, as I said, the Buddhist community is made up of these two divisions, monastics and lay people. Okay, and the two exist in a, call it a symbiotic relationship, a relationship of mutual support. But now I think that this is a certain an important development that's taking place in Western Buddhism. What has happened in traditional Asian Buddhism is that lay people have tended to, I would say, to undervalue their own potentials, in that they take it that their task as lay people is to support the monastics and in that way acquire merit which will come to their aid in advancing to a happy future life and eventually in the long run to their attainment of enlightenment. And so in traditional Asian Buddhism, lay people don't make a very serious effort to learn the Dharma well and to practice earnestly and seriously, but they take a rather passive role, almost resigning themselves to the role of being the supporters, the providers of the material needs of monastics. This is the case, I'm speaking from my experience in Sri Lanka. Okay, now in Western Buddhism, lay people approach the Dharma with a very keen interest. And because the lay people are not traditional Buddhists, they want to know what is actually at the heart of the Buddha's teachings. How can I practice these teachings? How can I get the full benefits of these teachings? And so I think lay people, if they're serious and earnest, can advance quite far within the Dharma. Now, particularly, we have so much Buddhist literature translated into English, and many of the most accomplished translators and Buddhist scholars today are lay people. For the Tibetan tradition, people like Jeffrey Hopkins, Robert Thurman, so we could say that the whole field of Buddhist literature is available in English for intensive study, and now intensive meditation retreats are given, which are open to lay people. And so lay people practice, very earnestly, very intensively. And in this way, lay people can make remarkable and substantial progress in their practice. At the same time, I would say that even though the Buddha has no closed fist of a teacher, and there's no special teachings that are reserved only for monastics, but that progress along the path to enlightenment does involve renunciation. And so a lay person, in order to advance significantly, has to develop an inner renunciation, which is difficult but possible. But still, the ideal conditions, the best supporting conditions for a life of renunciation, are those which are provided by the monastic life, which is why the monastic life should be the field of attraction for those who want to advance to make the most rapid progress on the way to liberation. But again, I would say, in their shared efforts to advance along this path to enlightenment, the lay people and monastics have their own distinct functions. And so the monastics do have the special function of being the representatives of the Triple Gem, of teaching and guiding the lay community. And the lay people, while studying and practicing themselves, should take on upon themselves the function of supporting and maintaining the monastic sangha. Okay, it's getting late now, so perhaps I could take one more question.
actually, they've all run out. So thank you very, very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yes.
And again, please, we want to extend our invitation for you to come and visit us.
Okay, I'll give that very serious thought.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, be well.
Okay.
Be well, thank you.
Okay, good night, is it?
Almost.
Okay, good evening to you. It's getting to be evening for you now.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.